Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jack London's big, icy adventure stories made him a celebrity in his day and have captivated Americans and more for a century since. Tales of hunger, survival, brute nature, and hard luck in the Yukon and beyond, in The Call of the Wild, White Fang, and more. A new biography reminds us he was much more than a spinner of gripping tales. Jack London grew up hard, was smacked hard by Gilded Age inequality, and was a passionate crusading socialist. This hour on Point, Jack London's life, adventures, and politics in a new biography. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is James Haley, writer and biographer. He wrote the award-winning biography of Texas hero Sam Houston. His latest is Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. James Haley, thank you so much for being with us.
Delighted to be with you, Tom.
This is a very well-told life story here. I really enjoyed it. I wonder if you'd start off. I mean, everybody more or less kind of knows about, you know, White Fang and The Call of the Wild and The Sea Wolf. At least generations have. We'll talk about whether they still do. But I wondered if you'd give us a sense of the economic circumstances of Jack London's upbringing that, in a way, explain a lot about both how he came to tell those stories and about his politics. What were the economic realities he faced very, very young?
Well, he was born in San Francisco in 1876. And his mother... San Francisco at that time was very wide open. Mm-hmm. In fact, a century later when it was full of hippies, I mean, they would have recognized the place from 100 years before. She was a spiritualist and a free lover and very San Francisco was just an open place. And she, I think the current phrase would be hooked up with an astrologer named William Cheney, who may or may not have been Jack London's father. But once she got pregnant, he abandoned her. And she was a single mother long before it became, you know, the fashionable thing to do. Mm-hmm. And he grew up in terrible circumstances. His mother was almost devoid of maternal affection. She farmed him out to an African-American wet nurse named Virginia Prentice for almost the first year of his life.
A huge influence in his life and interesting in its own right. And then
very much so, because Flora was an arrant racist. And Jenny Prentice, in her way, thought that black people were superior. So from his earliest childhood, he was getting very mixed signals about the racism of the late 19th century. But she married when he was 8 months old. She married a Civil War veteran, partly disabled, named John London, who worked very hard as much as he could with one lung. Plus Flora played the Chinese lottery. She was an hysteric. She had all these big schemes, and she would always lose whatever money he made, and they just went down.
Flora,
and down
Jack's
and down
mom,
and down.
Down and down, and that's the world that Jack London came up in, and it was hard. You described the various kinds of labor that he did at very young ages, and the economic pressures that eventually took him right up to the settings that are now so familiar in The Call of the Wild and more. Give us a sense of that series of efforts just to make a living.
Well, from age, maybe eight, he had a paper route morning and evening, so he was up as early as three. He delivered ice, he set pins in a bowling alley. When he finally got out of grammar school after eighth grade, which was as much of an education as he pretty much got, he went to work canning pickles at Hickmott's Produce Cannery for 10 cents an hour. At least 10 hours a day, and some days 24 hours straight.
Sounds
so
kind of homey, but canning pickles
gilded age from the ugly underbelly.
Canning pickles sounds kind of homey, but it was no doubt, you know, pushing the line.
Oh, there were fingers that were lopped off by the machine belts, and it was just a horrible place to work. It was a sweatshop in every sense of the word.
Take us on beyond the pickle canning and Jack London's early work.
Well, he finally discovered crime. He found out that, how should I say this, in Oakland, which is where they moved because it was cheaper living than San Francisco, the Southern Pacific Railroad had leased out a large amount of their coastal acreage to oyster beds, and they were eastern oysters because the native San Francisco oysters had all been killed off by mine tailings washing down from the gold rush.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had these guarded private oyster beds to supply the hotels in San Francisco. So he became an oyster pirate. And there's a small group of these guys who would rent or own sloops and go out and raid these oyster beds in the middle of the night and just brazenly sell them on the docks in Oakland, because the people in Oakland resented the railroad so badly. It was just a way of the little people getting their own back.
With a sense right there of why should the big railroad magnates own even the oysters in the bay?
That's right, because the estuaries around Oakland for generations had been pot hunting for the little people in Oakland. They could go fish or shoot ducks or whatever. And all of a sudden, these were fenced off and watched over with armed guards. And they felt that very, very keenly.
He read, he yearned, he had an imagination fed on Melville and Kipling, who he studied line by line in Flaubert. He wanted an education and kind of tried, but ended up back on the hard work path.
Repeatedly. And, you know, there's one of the reasons I wrote this book is that all the other biographies, and there's a bunch of them, sort of depend on the drama of his whole life to move the biography itself. But there are so many people who influenced him who just become sort of ciphers in those stories, and one of whom was Ina Coolbrith, the Oakland City Librarian. A lot of people don't realize that Oakland had the second public library in California. The first one was in Eureka. And she recognized his family's strife. She was herself divorced. She was an estranged granddaughter of Joseph Smith, who started the Mormon religion. And when she discovered this little boy coming into the public library with a stack of newspapers under his arm that he hadn't thrown yet, she guided his reading for the next 6 or 8 years. He read two books a week. And nobody at home really cared whether he read or not.
So there was a literary
idolized her.
There was a literary sensibility, but at the same time, tell us about the economics that pushed him to sea, pushed him to shoveling coal, pushed him into the Klondike.
Well, bless his heart, you know, he felt that poverty and felt the resentment so keenly that when the opportunity came to go to Alaska, he didn't go there looking for short story material. He went to try and get rich because he was the principal breadwinner in his family from the age of 15. You know, he would even turn over his earnings from the oyster piracy to his mother, and that was some of the best times they ever had. When he came back from Alaska after this incredible year in which he should have been killed 6 or 8 times over, he had gold worth about $4.50. You know, he had borrowed his grub stake from his stepsister, who he then had to worry about trying to pay back somehow. So he got to work in a steam laundry. And what really pushed him over the edge, was he got a job shoveling coal in a steam railway powerhouse. And he had read Horatio Alger all during his childhood.
Work hard, young man, and up you'll come.
Yes. He had to believe that if you were honest and hardworking and forthright and virtuous, that you would rise in the world. And so he interviewed with the president of this steam railway company. He said, yes, son, you know, you can become an electrical engineer, blah, blah, but you need to start at the beginning. So they put him to work shoveling coal. Now, this is 30 days a month, 10 hours a day for $30, basic, you know, the same 10 cent an hour wage that he'd been earning since he was a little child. That was a standard wage during the Depression in the 1890s.
And back-breaking.
He
had to wear leather splints, you write, to keep
yes,
at
he
it.
Yes, he sprained both his wrists and had to wear leather splints. He was just crippled up with cramps. Well, eventually, one of the firemen confessed to him that in this labor for which he got $30 a month, he was replacing two men who'd been paid $40 a month each. And that just, you know, when he realized the depth of the exploitation that not just he, but everybody like him were being put through. That's what put him on the road. He became a tramp and hoboed for a while.
We'll talk about that. It also gave him a sense of the world that you can hear coming through. And here's a little bit of the call of the wild. This is on tape. But just listen. Here, this is the dog thinking and talking and acting. But against the history that James Haley is telling us, you can hear Jack London behind.
Instincts, long dead, became alive again. The domesticated generations fell from him. In vague ways, he remembered back to the youth of the breed, to the time the wild dogs ranged in packs through the primeval forest and killed their meat as they ran it down. It was no task for him to learn to fight with cut and slash and the quick wolf snap, in this manner had fought forgotten ancestors. They quickened the old life within him, and the old tricks which they had stamped into the heredity of the breed were his tricks. And when, on the still cold nights, he pointed his nose at a star and howled, long and wolf-like, it was his ancestors, dead and dust, pointing nose at star and howling down through the centuries and through him.
From Jack London's The Call of the Wild. And James Haley, as you tell his story and then we hear those lines, you can almost hear the young Jack London awakening in that way to the fact that it's brute out there.
Yes, and oddly enough, many years later, he recycled that motif into a whole novel of ancient memory called Before Adam, in which a little boy goes to the zoo and is terrified by a lion because deep in his ancestral memory, he remembers his tree people who were terrified by the tawny one. So that became a sort of recurring motif. But when you look at his word usage and the way he constructs a passage. That's not something he ever learned. I mean, here's a guy who only had an eighth grade education. He went back to high school after tramping, but gave that up, eventually got what they now call a GED, went to Berkeley for a semester. But he was an artist, pretty much complete in the way he was going to use language by the time he was 15.
James Haley, stand by. The new biography is Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about The Call of the Wild creator, Jack London. His adventure stories made him famous. His politics were a tougher sell. They were fiery. They were passionate. James Haley tells the story in his new biography, Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. And it is terrific. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jim Haley joins us from Austin, Texas. And here, just a little bit of perhaps his most famous short story, To Build a Fire. This, again, in the ice, in the north, and building that fire is more than this man can manage. He's there with his dog. Finally, he's failed, and he's dying. From Jack London's To Build a Fire.
As the twilight drew on, its eager yearning for the fire mastered it, and with a great lifting and shifting of forefeet, it whined softly, then flattened its ears down in anticipation of being chidden by the man. But the man remained silent. Later, the dog whined loudly, and still later it crept close to the man and caught the scent of death. This made the animal bristle and back away. A little longer it delayed, howling under the stars that leaped and danced and shone brightly in the cold sky. Then it turned and trotted up the trail in the direction of the camp it knew, where there were other food providers and fire providers.
Cold nature. The man dying, the dog moving on. Just a bit from Jack London's famous short story, To Build a Fire. James Haley is with us. His new biography is Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. And let's get a call. Gary in Murray, Utah. Gary, you're on the air with Jim Haley.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. What do you know of Jack London, Gary?
Well, I have enjoyed an early anthology of his writings that I inherited from my father-in-law. I think it was produced by Reader's Digest, you know, one of those compilation-type books back in the 1940s.
And what struck you in it?
What really struck me was that his experiences with the Klondike Gold Rush were a little capitalistic in nature. And then when he got, I think it was yellow fever, and took a raft down the Yukon River, clear to the sea, I could see how that short experience would give him so much material for his Alaskan stories. But I also was deeply moved by the story of the people of the abyss in London, where he attempted to divest himself of his wealth and fame, except for a coin sewn into his sleeve, and he went down into the area of London where people were so poor, I couldn't even sleep on the park benches.
Gary, I'm glad you raised that. I mean, we all know the adventure stories, but as James Haley makes clear, and you know well from your early reading, this was a novelist and a journalist, traveled the world, was in many, many settings. Gary, thanks for your call. Jim Haley, take us to that. I mean, Gary sees in that rough, rough passage through the Yukon and down through Canada, down to the Alaska, maybe the transition. You write about his tramp time and his jail time in Buffalo, New York, as a time when, what did he say, that he could feel his patriotism leaking out through the soles of his shoes or something like that.
Yeah. What he discovered was, well, he had been pinched for vagrancy, which was kind of ironic because he'd been a tramp. He'd been a deliberate vagrant for weeks. And he was walking down the street in Niagara Falls to see Niagara Falls when a commission constable who got paid by the number of people that he rounded up, arrested him. He went to night court. He asked for a lawyer. They laughed at him. He wanted to plead not guilty. They told him to shut up, and he got 30 days. So when he saw how the legal system reinforced the economic system, that sort of finished it for him and the American way of economy. Funny thing about Call of the Wild is that that was not his first big hit. In fact, his publisher, George Brett, didn't even think it would sell. He didn't give him a royalty contract. He just gave him a little lump sum and said, well, I'll publicize it if people start buying it.
Right.
His first big hit, in fact, was The People of the Abyss, because he had been doing some articles for some magazines like Overland Monthly about war and militaristic things, and he got an assignment to go to South Africa and interview generals who had fought in the Boer War. And when he got to New York, the war was over, and the generals had dispersed. And it was Brett who sent him to London to write People of the Abyss. You see, back then, socialism was a much different entity than it is now. It was far more respectable. Back then, Christian socialism wasn't an oxymoron. It was a movement. And even here in Texas, our most famous Baptist preacher, Redden Andrews, ran for governor in 1910 on the socialist ticket, and he finished second. Everybody thought it was terrific. So when he went to England, he was working for a publisher in Macmillan, and Brett, who were deeply into the Christian reform movement. And what you have to understand, and this caller from Utah just mentioned the fact that he went there for a capitalist reason. To him, socialism wasn't taking from the rich and giving to the poor. To Jack London, socialism was the idea that the workers should get some equitable share of the economy that they create. And when he went to London, he went in the guise of a down-on-his-luck American sailor, and he blended into the – actually, it was the Whitechapel district of Jack the Ripper celebrity. And what he discovered there was just horrifying, the way people were living. And he wrote that book in just the space of, oh, a month or so.
The People of the Abyss.
I'm sorry?
The People of the Abyss there.
Yeah. Are we ready to read a little bit from that?
Here's a good
way that he used his language. And talking about the young people, and of course these poor folk were packed whole families into a single room. And he said, the youngsters run the streets, and by the time they are 12 or 14, the room issue comes to a head, and out they go on the streets for good. The boy, if he be lucky, can manage to make the common lodging houses, and he may have any one of several ends. But the girl of 14 or 15, forced in this manner to leave the one room called home, and able to earn at the best a paltry 5 or 6 shillings a week, can have but one end. And the bitter end of that one end is such as that the woman whose body the police found this morning in a doorway on Dorset Street, Whitechapel. Homeless, shelterless, sick, with no one with her in her last hour, she had died in the night of exposure. She was 62 years old and a match vendor. She died as a wild animal dies. Now, when that book came out, immediately before Call of the Wild, yes, it sold hot copies in the United States. Of course, the British press were thoroughly offended that an American writer would come to England and expose their seamy side.
This was not just voyeurism for Jack London. This was very, very deeply held passion about these circumstances.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. And he would – what hurt him was that he could write a book like People of the Abyss, and people lionized him. But when he tried to tell people that, hey, you know what, there's a lot of places in the United States where conditions aren't any better, they didn't want to hear it. He became a very highly paid lecturer, and he would go out, and he'd want to start his lectures, comrades, the revolution. He really believed there was a revolution coming, and nobody wanted to hear it. They wanted to hear about Alaska. And later on, when he developed this South Seas motif after he and his second wife cruised the Pacific on the Snark.
Their own yacht,
about
it
Hawaii
should be pointed out.
Tahiti.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, they didn't want to hear about social conditions, just as today. I mean, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is that the economic conditions today so mirror what he lived through, the disparity of wealth and the fact that CEOs of a corporation earn, you know, whatever it is, 400 times the wage that the average worker gets. And he would recognize that today and just shake his head at the complacency that most people who manage their own little island of getting by just don't care about the people out there on the street. And he would recognize that in a heartbeat, and he would probably despair over it.
I want to look at that in economic terms, also get a racial prism here, because he had a strong one there too, and one that doesn't translate so well today. But let's get a caller to Ryan in Providence, Rhode Island. You're on the air with James Haley.
Hi, good morning. How are you doing?
Well.
I have a question concerning the Iron Heel. I stumbled upon it a while ago, and I was wondering how exactly Jack London came upon such a nuanced view of socialism and revolution in terms of what he proposes in the book, The Iron Heel.
The Iron Heel, 1908, the book. Where did he get
it? What a great
education.
Question. I want to dive right into
okay,
that one.
Okay, good, Ryan.
Ryan, I'm so glad you asked about The Iron Heel, because Jack London actually learned his socialism out there being a tramp, because not all those hobos were down-and-out disabled laborers. There were some highly educated intellectuals who just didn't want to play the game anymore. And he met people like Frank Strawn Hamilton, who was a highly educated socialist, and he sort of picked it up out there on the road. Now, when he wrote The Iron Heel, which is sort of a dystopian novel about life after the machines take over, he had gotten that idea from another book that he had read. So he wrote The Iron Heel, which was set, oddly enough, in the year 1984. The Iron Heel was read by George Orwell, who had an idea for his own dystopian novel. And so he wound up becoming in the middle of this sequence of novels about what happens when the state becomes that inhuman. And Iron Heel sold well enough, but it wasn't one of his really takeoff books. Like Revolution was.
But there it was, also on that same theme. It didn't sell so well, but he was the highest paid writer of his time for no small number of years, Jim.
He was, and he also had a really deep sense. What you have to understand is Jack London was a walking contradiction. He was, if God on his throne had sat down and tried to think, mm-hmm. what's the way, how can I make the angriest socialist who ever lived, his life experience up to the age of 20, mm-hmm. He couldn't have done better. Mm-hmm. And yet all his life he was a capitalist. He became a progressive agrarian. He acquired a ranch with experimental techniques of agriculture. He invested in products, and when he lost his money, he didn't complain. Like I said, to him, socialism wasn't about sitting on your backside and collecting money from those who can afford to support you. It was about people just getting a fair shake.
And when he sailed the South Seas, as you say, on the Snark, that was his own yacht he was sailing on.
$35,000, which really angered the socialist community in the United States, that he would live such a way. After he spent several months in Japan and Korea as a war correspondent covering the Russo-Japanese War, mm-hmm. which is a very interesting segment of his life. But he enjoyed the good life. I mean, he kept a Korean valet for the rest of his life. Nakata was Japanese, but he always had an Asian valet for the rest of his life.
Who called him master.
Yes. And, you know, there again, that goes back to the mixed signals that he got from his mother, saying that anybody darker than you, if they're even Portuguese, they're not as good as you. And Virginia Prentice, his wet nurse, mm-hmm. was very, very dark. And she wore it as a badge of pride. And she believed she was had lived through the whole Gone with the Wind thing. She was an ex-slave who had gone through the horrors of Reconstruction. And she told him that black people were superior to white people. Because look at what the way white people treat each other and treat black people. So he had this incredible stew of conflict about how to regard race and racism and racialism that really he never quite put to rest. I think the closest he came to resolving it was after he went to Hawaii in 1907, and he saw what an idyllic culture they had before white people came along. So the and as you know, that whole story of how we got our hands on the islands.
But even then, so, he encouraged the U.S. moving into Hawaii, as I
he did, but that was a geopolitical reality. In fact, he believed that either the United States or Japan must have Hawaii because Hawaii wasn't strong enough to stand on her own, which, by the way, if you look at Hawaiian history, King Kalakaua had come to that conclusion as far back as the 1880s. In fact, he tried to marry off his niece, Kaiulani, to a Japanese imperial prince so that the Hawaiian Islands would become part of the Japanese Empire.
But London could
say the Japanese were even more racist than the Americans, so they, you know, smiled and said no thank you and then shuddered when they were off by themselves.
Yeah.
But yeah, he knew as a matter of geopolitical reality. And by the way, when he was covering the Russo-Japanese War, he got the idea that the Japanese were going to start the conflict, but without a declaration of war. They would start it by a sneak attack, which they did with a naval attack on a Russian naval base far removed from the theater of operations.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think
Sounds familiar.
Before Pearl Harbor we would have been paying attention.
But I'm looking at what Jack London here is saying back in the day, and it sounds so wild. Now, I am first of all a white man, and only then a socialist, he said. And then him saying, the history of civilization is a history of wandering, a wandering sword in hand, of strong breeds clearing away and hewing down the weak and less fit, the dominant races, you know, and on and on. I mean, it sounds...
Yeah, he was fascinated by Darwin, and that translated into a kind of social Darwinism, which became... there were days on which he was more racist than others, you have to say, because he did believe that the minority races around the world. I mean, here's a guy who'd been to Samoa, who'd been to the Marquesas Islands. In fact, when he and Charmian would go ashore, they'd be armed because these were still places where there were headhunters and there were people who had hosted them at their plantations who were later eaten. So, yeah, there was a deep racist streak as there was throughout his time. But it was an issue that he never resolved. And there are, you know, when you take a quote from Jack London, you can say, oh, my goodness, what the most appalling racist. But when he would cover Jack Johnson's fights for one newspaper or another, with the Jim like the Jim Jeffries fight, he gave full credit. You know, Jack Johnson was just the superior boxer, and he would go – London was an amateur boxer, and he knew the sport inside and out. And there was nothing of the great white hope sort of racist tint to his covering of Jack Johnson's fights. He just said he's a superior boxer.
And his black wet nurse, Virginia Prentice, did he stay close to her?
All his life. In fact, he always called her Mammy Jenny, and she hated that name. She would always get him to try and get him to stop calling her that. When he became an oyster pirate, she lent him the $300 to buy a sloop to go out and become an oyster pirate, which he paid back with interest.
After taking
And she was always, in fact, she and her husband moved to Oakland from San Francisco to stay close to him.
James Haley, please stand by in Austin, Texas. The new biography is Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about The Call of the Wild creator, writer Jack London. His adventure stories made him a celebrity, made him famous a century ago. His politics were fierce, but they were a tougher sell. You can join the conversation. Did you grow up with Jack London's tales? Hearing London's story, does it make you want to read him again? Who's our Jack London today? I don't know. Eminem? MIA? James Haley joins us from Austin, Texas, author of the biography Sam Houston, and now Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. Joe in Norfolk, Virginia. Joe, you're on the air.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me on today. I just have something very briefly to say. I have not read Jack London, but I have read some of the socialist authors of that time, Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, people like that.
Who are good friends of his, by the way.
Good friends of Jack London's, Jim says. So what are you thinking, Joe?
I did not know that, but Here's a statement a great author once said that has always stayed with me. Capitalism did not create poverty. It inherited it. And they did not see that. The difference between 1900 was so great than that of 1800 that it is impossible for me to understand how somebody cannot see how capitalism was so much a greater system than socialism ever could be.
But now that you hear Jack London's coming up story, that sort of, you know, brute work from very early on from 10 cents an hour, does it make it any clearer, Joe, or not?
Well, I think overall people in this country were not wrenched from the farms and put into the cities to go to work in those terrible places.
Well, of course, many did, and many emigrants did, certainly, but yeah.
And they wanted to, because living on the farm was so awful, and as bad as being in the city, it was so much better than being out in the country, and things were getting better. Capitalism was progressive. Socialism was regressive. That's just my point of view.
Joe, thanks for your call.
Well, can I jump in on
yes,
that one,
please.
Tom?
How would Jack London have responded to that with his live
Jack London would say, and okay, I'll channel Jack London.
Okay.
He would say, yes, capitalism is a good system. Unrestrained, laissez-faire, abusive capitalism is a bad system. You know, he was a capitalist all his life. I mean, he invested, made money. He lost money. He lent his celebrity to various products, including a non-alcoholic grape juice, once he decided he better stop drinking.
Right.
In fact, we can talk about his alcoholism in a minute if you want to.
Yes.
But no, to him, the evil was in the abuse of the system, not the system itself.
And the socialism that he envisioned, was it anything like the socialism that emerged in the 20th century? What did that mean to a socialist in 1900?
No, socialism, and he would give long street corner speeches about this. To him, socialism was broken down into so many subgroups. And the socialism that emerged was probably more tinctured by people like Emma Goldman, who believed in no government at all. And that kind of thing. He was much more maybe of a Fabian, or, you know, one of the more milder forms of socialism. Now, there were times when he would get very frustrated and he would preach revolution and assassination. But so many of those comments that he made were taken out of context. He would give a whole speech about how, you know, in our political system, we can vote and we can change things, and this is what we need to do. But in Russia, they don't. So I have a lot of sympathy for Bolsheviks and assassins in Eastern Europe, because they do not have the political ability to change their system. Now, that whole lump would come out in the papers, who hated him eventually, they would just publish, you know, I'm in league with Bolsheviks and assassins. And that's all people ever heard of him. And they've never heard the more nuanced context.
When you describe
how he was a guy who needed larger context to explain himself.
When you describe how he thought and talked about it, what he's describing sounds not entirely unlike what emerged in mid-century America as the normie. You write, socialism did not mean taking from the rich and giving to the poor. It did mean that the working class should reap an equitable share of the economy that their labor creates and not be relegated to a permanent underclass of servants who will never have a chance to advance in life. That's why a lot of people came to this country.
Yep. Yep. In fact, when he went to England to write People of the Abyss, this is one of those things that I really wanted to capitalize on in the book, is so many of his biographies are either literary criticism, you know, Jack London was so a great writer, damn it, or just kind of fast and punchy, The Adventurous Life. Mm-hmm. But when he sailed to England, only a couple of biographies even mention this, he crossed on the Majestic, which is the largest, fastest ship in the world at that time.
Think Titanic.
And here's a sailor. Think what that vision meant to him of being on this enormous ship. But also, being a socialist, he knew that those Atlantic liners were the epitome. They were the great symbol of Western capitalism. And while their reputations might be made with Astors and Vanderbilts in the first-class staterooms, he knew that those bills were being paid by these holds full of third-class steerage immigrants coming to the United States, you know, to be as abused and just thrown like human coal into the capitalist boilers as they were in Europe.
Velvet
and
upstairs,
when you read the letters
down,
that he wrote from on the ship, that was exactly what was on his mind.
Let's go to Phyllis in Newton, Massachusetts. Phyllis, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is for James Haley about a Jack London novel that's kind of obscure that I never, ever hear mentioned. I read it when I was 9 years old. It was called Before Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Ah, yes.
It was serialized in a magazine.
Yes.
And it's about a man who has, it's science fiction. It's about a man who has a memory of a life that he lived millions of years before as an early human. And I, it's a wonderful book, and I loved it, and I'm just curious as to why it's so seldom mentioned.
Oh, I'm getting goosebumps just because you asked that question. Before Adam is an what they call an atavistic novel. It begins when that guy is a little boy, and he goes to the zoo, and he's terrified by this lion. And he has this ancestral memory of life millions of years ago. And because he was not a naturalist by follow. He was a naturalist. He began that movement. And that book, if I remember right, it sold something like 60,000 copies when it came out. It was just a ripaway bestseller. And it struck people so completely that there were anthropology professors, one of them even at Yale, who used it as a textbook for what life must have been like. Millions of years ago. You're right. He wasn't just the animal guy with White Fang in Call of the Wild. There was another wonderful novel of his called The Star Rover, which was about astral projection, and this character lives all these different lives at different times. You know, he was this protean creative force, and sadly, it was his politics that pretty much got him banned from the bookstores and public consciousness. It's kind of like, you know, in our history, we have to, a lot of our heroes, we have to give them a bath before we can put them up in our pantheon. You know, whether it's Lindbergh from the right, who was almost a Nazi. Well, we had to scrub him off because he crossed the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Or Helen Keller from the left, who was almost as rabid a socialist as London was, but, well, you know, she raised all that money for blind people, so we give her a bath.
Cleaned up.
And
nice.
Jack London, his best books were forgotten and put away. And I think Star Rover and Before Adam are two of his very, very best.
When did that happen?
I'm glad you called and asked that.
Me too, Phyllis. Thank you. Did that banning, that banishment happen when he was still alive or post-mortem?
He came in waves. He was very popular, and then he would give some speeches and become very unpopular. Toward the end of his life, going back for a minute, you talked about his being the highest paid writer in America. Mm-hmm. Of course, he supported his mother. He supported his first wife and their two daughters. He supported Jenny Prentice. He would give handouts to all the old hobos who would come visit him. So even though he was making a fortune, he also there was his own expansive life. You know, what's now the Jack London State Park in California was his beauty ranch with all his experiments. And then there was the yacht was cost a fortune. And then there was the Wolf House, which was a huge mansion that he finally wanted to live the good life. And it burnt down the day it was finished. But toward the end of his life, one of the ways that he resurrected himself was with an autobiography about his drinking I've really wasted so much of life. It was called John Barleycorn.
Yeah.
And
John Barleycorn as in The Soul of Whiskey.
Yes. Which I think comes from Robert Burns originally.
Mm-hmm.
But when John Barleycorn came out in 1913, there again, he turned his own capitalist instincts to he's in the Sonoma Valley. He can grow grapes. Well, he sells his grapes to a grape juice company, not to a winery. And that regained a lot of his popularity. But basically, after there was sort of a fire of creativity after he came back from the South Seas. But other than that, he was pretty much done. He went to cover the Mexican Revolution in 1914. But creatively, he was so spent from 1,000 words a day his whole life. That was his goal, 1,000 words a day. And a lot of what he wrote, even he considered to be hack work because he had bills to pay.
Died of a morphine overdose in November 1916, accidental or otherwise?
You will find books to say both. When Irving Stone wrote Sailor on Horseback in 1938, which is still the standard Jack London biography, he was very clever in his wording of saying that London, when they found him comatose in the, early in the morning, that they found a little piece of paper where he had figured out, quote, the fatal dose of morphine. Well, if he was going to take a fatal dose, he would have just shot himself with everything he had. You know, I think what was going on, because his letters of the days immediately preceding his death He was on an upswing. He was making plans to see his daughters. He had just won a lawsuit where people downstream from his ranch had sued him for damming a stream, but he won that lawsuit and had hosted them at a luncheon, and so that was behind him. He had really a lot of optimism in those last few days, but by then his kidneys were shot. He had uremia. He was on Salvarsin, which some indication that he was fighting venereal disease because he was never a faithful husband.
Huge womanizer, you write.
Oh, yeah, big time. And in fact, that's one of the challenges of writing this book was not to be captured by the guy. He was a terrible husband, totally unsuitable father, and at times a very difficult man. And not dissimilar with the book I wrote on Sam Houston. I mean, my fascination with him was how did he accomplish all this in the face of all these personal demons, which makes his literary accomplishments all the more amazing to me that he did it while he was drinking himself to death.
And those accomplishments setting up decades of big writers that would come, Dos Passos and Hemingway, the naturalists, you say.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In fact, one caller mentioned Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Steffens, good friends of his. Jack London was a keystone of those San Francisco bohemians. And he mentored both Upton Sinclair and gave a really good review to The Jungle, you know, his book about sure. the Chicago stockyards, and also Sinclair Lewis. Well, they looked up to, in fact, Sinclair Lewis was very poor and had a hard time, and Jack London bought plot ideas from his trunk of, oh, this would make an interesting book. Not because he needed book ideas. He just wanted to find a way to help the guy out.
What a life. John in Westboro, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hello. I was delighted to hear of this segment coming up, and I just wanted to speak about John Barleycorn. John Barleycorn, which you've already spoken of, was one of the primary, well, the prohibitionists used it as some of their primary propaganda, just telling the story of how terrible it was to be a drinker.
How it would take a man down, yeah.
Well, yeah, and one of the things I remember most about it was where he was talking. I was on a road trip for about a year and a half, and I picked that up in a library, and he was talking about for the cost of a beer in the bar, someone would lay out the entire city for you. And where else could you get that kind of information? So it was unique.
And to Jack London, where else could he get that kind of camaraderie?
Exactly. I mean, it's if you've ever lived on the road, you know exactly what he's talking about. So
yep.
It was excellent story, and I've read, I've very much enjoyed the hour, and thank you very much.
John, I appreciate your call. James Haley, you take us in the prologue of the book to the moment when a very miserable Jack London carves on the wall of a shack up in the Yukon, Jack London, minor author, January 27, 1898. We just got a couple minutes. I wish you'd give us the story of how he came to be in that bunk, miserably carving that in the wall that really put him into the setting that brought us his most famous adventure stories. But there was news that gold was found in the Klondike, and then?
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, I'm watching the sweep hand on my watch,
yeah,
so I don't
good.
Go more than 2 minutes.
Yeah.
When he came back, at 17, he went to sea on a sealing schooner. Went to Japan, went to the Bonin Islands, slaughtered seals in the Bering Sea, came back. And the depression that had been caused by the Panic of 1893 was in its very depth. Well, he didn't find steady employment. And then when gold was discovered in the Yukon, a lot of people, because Americans went to Alaska, a lot of people have the idea that the gold was in Alaska. No, mm-hmm. the gold was in the Yukon Territory of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to sail up the Inside Passage to Dyea or Skagway and then walk up and up and up the mountains until you got to either White Pass or Chilkoot Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd go downhill. But, oh, my Lord, you'd have to build your own boat and then float your stuff down all these rivers with the most horrific rapids in the world. I mean, they had names like the Horse's Mane, where your boat would just be tossed up in the air.
He had 500 pounds to carry. You say he'd carry a bit of it and then go back for the rest, carry a bit more, mile.
Yes, he could carry 75 to, yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, he could carry 75 to 100 pounds at one trip. And you had to have, actually, each person, the Canadian Mounties, wouldn't let you go into the country unless you had 1,000 pounds.
And then winter closing in on him as they were crossing these lakes. You described them crossing one of the last lakes toward the gold fields with the wake freezing behind them as winter came on.
Yes, it was their third attempt to get across the lake. And all those other guys who weren't as hardy as they were had to spend the winter there on Marsh Lake.
His gums were bleeding. His skin was slack. The doctor said he was going
to... Yeah, he had scurvy. He had the Klondike plague almost immediately. And a visiting doctor said, you're going to die if you don't find medical treatment. And, of course, the irony for all these Americans who left just as soon as the word got here in summer of 1897, well, it took about 6 months to get up there. So what do you do? You wind up hitting the gold fields in the middle of the Arctic winter. You know, so and by then, all the good claims were staked anyway. Well, they just decided to pull up on an island, split up island in the river, and he went up Henderson Creek. There was a line shack up there where he could sort of pan for some gold on his own. And he's lonely, he's sick, he's miserable, he's 22 by now, and he had had some success. You know, he won a writing contest when he was 17, even with his eighth grade education. And he knew he could write, and that was when he decided that I've got to find a way to tell people what's wrong with the world, and I've got to find a way not to have to work with my back.
You write, in this frozen crucible, he reached a personal epiphany. He would never advance in life as a laborer. He turned and scrawled on the log next to his bunk, Jack London, miner, author, January 27th, 1898, and the rest is history. James Haley, it's a terrific biography. Thanks for writing it, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for letting me be with you.
James Haley, author of Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.